It requires a certain amount of courage and maturity and intelligence to see yourself objectively. And so if we can see ourselves objectively, we won't be surprised at our suffering. Yeah, but it is possible to be in a situation where, I mean, dovetailing. Like, hey, you're really just pigging out. No, I'm dovetailing. So, because there's a line between, like, to what extent am I just being natural, and like Krishna says, everyone follows their nature. So it's not, in other words, an artificial life is not sustainable. I mean, Krishna says the only sustainable lifestyle is one that's actually natural. It's one that actually takes into consideration our real situation. And yet, just as one can be too austere, one can be too self-indulgent. So that, like, you go to a gym to work out, which gurus do. I mean, you would never accept a guru's bona fide unless he was like, you know. Exactly. So it's like if you go to a gym, you can work out too much, you know, take on too much and hurt yourself, or you can do too little. So, I mean, to me, Krishna is the supreme personality of personal trainer. And it's like when you go to a gym and you work out, I mean, there's a sense in which it's pain. Like they say, no pain, no gain. But it's good because it's healthy. You realize you're actually helping yourself. So,
but the trainer will be happy if you work for it.
Exactly. So therefore,
harder than we would normally work without the training.
Well, but there's sometimes devotees work too hard, because some devotees have, I don't know, they too much like the sense of martyrdom or some Christian sense of, you know, sacrificing yourself, and some devotees, you know, actually ruin their own health spiritually or materially because they take on too much. They put themselves in an artificial situation. And some devotees are too self-indulgent. So it's a question of balance. It's like a good workout. In other words, I'm challenging myself, but I'm not hurting myself. And I'm not also not being too self-indulgent. It's a question of finding, you know, it's like a good workout.
Wow.
Spiritual life is just finding your level, where it's, and everyone's level will be different. You know, they always say that in yoga class, like they say it so much, so many times, you want to go strangle a yoga teacher sometimes, but they keep saying, like, you're not competing with anyone. And I was like, do not say that again. Yeah, so...
Your own yoga.
Yeah, so it's like that. I mean, if you go into a gym or take a yoga class based on your condition, what's important is you get a good, healthy workout. And the person next to you, it's different. So everyone has their own level. What's a good spiritual workout? And so you have to find... To me, spiritual life is just like, it's like personal training. You have to find your level. What's a good workout for you? It's not too much, it's not too little. And that's what Krishna emphasizes in the Bhagavad Gita. That balance. Yuktahara viharasya. Even like in moderation, you have to have recreation. Vihara. So devotees that never, you know, have any time for fun, they get weird. Always a little too serious. Gotta lighten you up a bit. Actually, she's the funniest.
She takes great pictures.
How did you meet everybody?
You do tell a few more jokes than we used to take our walks in New Vrindavan. Ali comes up with a lot of good new material. So suffering. It's like if you haven't been working out or... Yeah, when we suffer a lot, it's because there was some real infection there. Sometimes it requires, like, what do they call it? Deep tissue massage?
Yeah.
There's actually a shorter word for that, you know, torture. So... Yeah, it's like if you know, if it really hurts a lot, it's because you're out of shape. And according to normal, well, social psychology, you can be with people, whether you're a guru or a, you know, super Mataji or whatever. You know, I mean, like whoever you are, I really don't use the M word. So, it's like whatever, you know, man or woman, because all of us can at times find ourselves in circles of people that highly approve of us and say nice things to us. And we can have the idea that we're really doing well because people around us are, you know, giving us that kind of feedback. And, I mean, that's valuable. Feedback from good devotees is very valuable. Sometimes feedback from... I'll tell a story at my own expense just to exhibit my extraordinary humility. What, you know that saying, if I was just a little more humble, I'd be perfect. So... I'll tell a story. In 1982, out in Alachua, I had that health problem where I had to go to the... Hey, the rivers! Hey, you guys, come on in. Can you hear back there? I was telling you a story at my own expense. It's meant to demonstrate my humility. It's in 1982, at the height of the Zonal Acharya thing, I mean, I was like, because we were like completely isolated. I spent years of my life surrounded by people who only worship me. And so I just, you know, you start to believe your own press.
Yeah.
So anyway, I ended up going to the hospital in 82, and so I had that heart valve thing. And so anyway, they took me to the emergency ward. And so I had to, I had to go to the bathroom. I had to relieve myself. And so it was like really becoming painful. Like you just like, it was like you're going to explode. And so, I said to this nurse, there was this nice nurse. She was like this pretty young lady from South Africa, red haired lady. And, gurus always are observant about details like that. And so anyway, I told her that, you know, I have to the bathroom. And she said, well, first we have to run these tests to make sure there's no life-threatening situation. Just, you know, they started running all, she started doing, checking this and checking that. Meanwhile, I really thought I was going to explode. And I was so used to just having my commands obeyed because I was living in this little world only surrounded by faithful followers. So I said to the lady, I really need to do that now. She just stopped, put her hands on her hips, and said to the acharya for that entire region. And she said to me, will you stop being such a baby? And so, of course, I slapped her. I'm just kidding, I didn't slap her. But, yeah, so, and it's funny, when she said that to me, I was like so shocked, because it's been so long since anyone dared to speak like that to me. That, well, one thing was, all my pain was gone. It's like, I never forgot that. Will you stop being such a baby? And so, anyway, so it was Krishna. It was just Krishna. So Krishna spoke to that nurse. So I stopped being such a baby. It's funny. So we have to, it's very easy. It's very easy to drift into seeing Krishna consciousness as this is my religion. Like whether you're born in it or whether you converted, it's like, this is my religion, I believe in Krishna. And for human beings who are sort of inert, spiritually inert, it's like it's the most natural thing. It's natural to have religion. And that's why, despite all the attempts to promote atheism, it really doesn't work, because it's actually natural for human beings to have a religion. But to be actually spiritually progressive, to be really trying to make spiritual advancement, is something very different than just having a religion. And we see that devotees So I ask, you know, I ask very serious questions, like, you know, were you there yesterday in the temple? I did my shock jock routine.
I heard about it.
Oh, you heard about it? So I was like, because like, for example, let's say, oh my God. Let's say, for example, you take a little town. Like, what if it turns out in some little town like Archer, Florida, that, let's say, 90% of the people in the town are Christian. And let's say most of them go to church. Would you call that a spiritual town? The fact that they all have a religion and go to church once a week, would you call Archer or Williston or High Springs or Alachua spiritual towns? Are those spiritual communities? And obviously not. So is, let's say, like in Alachua County, do the devotees constitute, sociologically speaking, are they a spiritual community? Or are they simply people who share a common religion? I mean, Gainesville's different things. It's like this, you know, it's still a very strong spiritual community. But, so, would an objective, impartial person say that Alachua is a spiritual community? Or would he say it's simply a bunch of people who have the same religion and go on the weekends sometimes to their church?
What?
Pick up the can of beans. Watch out. Someone's going to get hit.
No, there is. But would you... Oh, my God.
A lot of people?
Attracting a crowd.
Hare Krishna.
Wait, just one moment.
Wait, you're going to get the power on. Okay, in response to what you said, I mean, without question, there are a number of very serious spiritual practitioners in that area.
That congregate?
Yeah, that congregate. Yeah. And so we could say there is a spiritual community. But my question was, is this working?
It's going to be working in a moment.
But my question was not, is there a spiritual community? I mean, the answer is obviously yes. Because there are serious... Oh my God. Total control. This is what it's all about, being an ISKCON leader. You get these experiences. So, is this too loud?
What?
Is that too loud?
I'm going to take away the intimacy of
that. Yeah, no, softer. So the question is, I mean, there is a group of people in Alachua who are spiritual practitioners, undoubtedly. But if you talk about the community as a whole...
Who do you refer to as a community?
That's a very good question. That's a very good question. Is there... I mean, I'm asking these questions not in a critical way. This is not just like... I think these are interesting, objective questions. Can we speak meaningfully, in sociological terms, objective terms, not what we want to believe, but in terms of what an objective, professionally trained person would say, is there a community, say, in Alachua County?
Is there a community in Alachua?
Is there one community? Is there... Can you say that all the people in Alachua County who, let's say, in some way or another are loyal to Prabhupada, do they constitute objectively a community?
Yes.
Or are there a series of communities, loosely like a confederation of communities?
Yeah. I go with the whole thing.
But then, if you say the whole thing is a community...
Including everyone,
then the question is, I think it's a fair question, is it, I mean fair in the sense that, I'm not trying to say what the answer is, but is it a spiritual community?
Yeah, because it provides association of sadhusanga. There's a constant sadhusanga being provided by the template of...
No, but to offer sangha doesn't mean that everyone takes it. In other words, what is an objective definition of a spiritual community? If you say it's a large group of people who share certain values, and some of those people take advantage of the spiritual resources, and some of them don't. Some of them, for example, the Bhagavatam says, the fact that there are saintly persons, and there are actually a number of saintly persons in Alaska, even the people who live there, not just people who come to me. And so, but the question is, in terms of the extent to which one takes advantage of that association, the extent to which one submissively hears from those persons, the extent to, at what point can you say that someone's life is a spiritual life, and at what point can you say that a community of people is a spiritual community, as opposed to a community whose ultimate values are spiritual. For example, you could have a community of Christians whose ultimate value is, let's say, to love God. But I don't think it follows that if you have a group of people whose highest value is spiritual, it means that that group of people is necessarily a spiritual community, even though they may hold certain values.
So what constitutes a spiritual community? What is the definition of a spiritual community?
That's a very good question. Vishambar, you're a college student. I would be interested to see, I mean, what is a reasonable, anyone, you too, what is a reasonable definition, an objective definition, which could apply to any community, not simply ours, because what's good for the goose is good for the gander. So what is a reasonable, fair definition, sociologically speaking, or religiously, of a spiritual community, as opposed to a religious community, as opposed to a community that shares a particular religion? Because you can have a community that, let's say, shares a common religion, but you might not call it a religious community. I'm not sure I would call Williston, Florida, a religious community, although probably almost everyone there is a Christian. They share a common religion.
So like the Amish, they are a spiritual community, aren't they?
Are the Amish a spiritual community? Well, you have to make these distinctions. Spiritual community, religious community.
So they're a religious community.
Are the Amish? You might say they're a religious community.
Mm-hmm. So they're based on religion. They're together for...
Here's another just thing to throw in to this discussion. The Bhagavatam makes a very almost shocking statement. The Bhagavatam says that... Is that person Archayam Eva Haraye Pujam Yaksha Dayehate, etc. That a person who, with faith, Shadaya, with faith, worships the Lord, but only in the deity form. In other words, their primary act of worship is to go to the temple and worship the Lord. But the person does not actively worship the Lord in other creatures. In other words, every living body is a mandir. And the same deity that's in the mandir, in the temple, is actually in the heart of every living being. And the reason we go to the temple is just to, you know, come to a certain consciousness so when you walk out the door, you see that same deity everywhere. Now, if by our practical activities, we're not offering the same worship to the deity in every creature that we do in the temple, then the Bhagavatam says we are on the material platform and that our life, in fact, is not a spiritual life. In other words, according to the Bhagavatam, one can go to a temple and faithfully worship the deity, and yet they are actually engaged, and not that activity may be spiritual, but their life is not spiritual.
That's namaparad also.
Which offense is it?
Disrespect to devotees. To disrespect to feel that, you know, the sense of entitlement that you are practicing, but the other person is not. So I'm better.
Yes.
So this whole.
Yes, but in response to what Jagori said, the Bhagavatam doesn't mention in this connection offending devotees or being envious. It's not talking about sort of like active envy or offenses against devotees. It's simply saying that you recognize the Lord and you worship the Lord specifically in the temple and not elsewhere. Yeah, Kanishtha. And the word kanishta in Sanskrit means lowest. It means the lowest. That's what the word means.
But it's still a devotee.
It's a devotee on the material platform.
Right.
The exact words of the Bhagavatam are sabhakta, that devotee, prakrita smrita, is considered to be on the material platform. So it gets back to the question, what is a spiritual community? And what is a spiritual life? Because I think that this gets into another socio-historical factor, and that is, in the early days of the movement, we made such a huge separation between devotees and fruitives
mm-hmm.
that non-devotees, that there's a sense that if you're a devotee, somehow you're spiritual. Because it's almost like, in our minds, to be spiritual means to be a devotee, and to be material means to be a non-devotee. And that's the great divide. That's the great dividing line, so that if you are a devotee, you're spiritual. And if your life is a little, well, whatever, on the whatever platform, that's okay, because you're still basically a devotee, and therefore you're still basically spiritual. And a community of such people, even though they may not be in top shape, it's still basically a spiritual community because we're devotees and not non-devotees.
But that's immature.
Yeah. Yeah, it's immature. Because when you make this... So therefore, internal distinctions among devotees, like... In other words, we don't really have... When we talk about devotees, we're fixed up or not fixed up. But there's a tendency to look upon any ISKCON community as a spiritual community. And I'm saying that... is that an objective assumption according to fair social science?
I have something to...
So by the estimation of two devotees, that Kanishtha Vikari can come to the platform of Madhyama, is possible?
Yeah, by practicing Krishna consciousness nicely.
The fact that the temples, they provide the environment
I'll get some water.
For spiritual enlightenment, for spiritual development. Yeah. That is
I've seen Christian churches where the people go there and actually try in their own way to cultivate love of God.
Mm-hmm.
That's why they're there. And love
true.
Of God, love of, yeah, it is. But I wouldn't call them spiritual. I wouldn't call the community spiritual.
I have a second mic here for those who want to ask questions.
Thank you.
You should pre-qualify them. So, Brenda, you're a bright young devotee. What do you have? Do you have anything to add to this?
But I need somebody that will pass the mic around. Any volunteers?
I want to focus on this issue. A reasonable objective definition for spiritual community and spiritual life. Yes, Ravi?
My understanding is that Krishna is in the center and everyone is working to please Krishna rather than themselves. Everyone acts for the pleasure of Krishna, keeping Krishna in the center and in their consciousness. Being Krishna conscious, then that would constitute a spiritual community.
Yeah, true. And so Krishna came down... Okay. But then we have to apply that standard and see if it actually fits. Yes.
Based on this question, should also that be based on the extent that they have Krishna at the center? Because they may have Krishna at the center 10% of the time.
Yeah. Exactly. And also, as Prabhupada clearly explained, spiritual life runs on two tracks. Spiritual life runs on two tracks. The preaching track and the worship track. So you can look at a particular community and just like do the math. You know, to what extent are their efforts and energy and time and money devoted to spreading the Krishna consciousness movement, and to what extent are those efforts devoted to worship for their own salvation and spiritual satisfaction? And Prabhupada said between these two tracks, the preaching track is actually the main one. And all of us, as I said yesterday, there's a rerun for some of you. The worship, we all need to go to the temple and worship to keep ourselves pure and strong so that we can go out and execute the primary mission. So is the primary mission in a particular community? I think that's a reasonable question.
Well, you're talking specifically about the Lhasa community?
No, I'm speaking about any community. Okay. Because we have to come up with a general definition which we can then apply specifically. If you start out with the specifics, you sort of get lost in the woods.
It's like having programs like Krishna.com, that's all PPG, yes, is coming from the farm. That's good.
I would say that Krishna.com is a very good thing, but it's not, I don't think it's a community effort.
Oh.
In other words, there are people living within the community that are doing very valuable preaching work. However,
where should it come from?
I think that a community, in order to be really a spiritual community, as opposed to having spiritual people in the community, which is not the same thing. For example, you could argue, and I would argue, that the duck pond is a community. They even have a community newsletter. And I live in the duck pond. And you can tell, because if you go there, you see all the ducks now where two are. So, I mean, the duck pond is a community, and I live in the community, and to the best of my knowledge, I'm practicing spiritual life in my own idiosyncratic way. And yet, I would not call the duck pond neighborhood a spiritual community. So,
it doesn't produce anything to enlighten people?
No, no, what I'm saying is the duck pond neighborhood is not a spiritual community, even though there may be people living there who are engaged in spiritual life. And so, a community, it seems to me, should have community projects. And so in order to say that a community is spiritual, the community should have spiritual projects, which are community projects. The fact that, let's say in Gainesville, people pay their taxes, there's a city government, they keep the lights on, the police patrol the streets, so therefore I can go out and chant my japa. In many, many ways, the city government of Gainesville and the neighborhood associations where I live are facilitating my spiritual life by providing security, street lights, they clean the streets, all kinds of services. You know, people mow their lawn so I can take japa walks and, you know, have a good time, and so on. So in many ways, the people around me are facilitating my activities, and yet they are not engaged in spiritual life, and the neighborhood in general is not a spiritual neighborhood. And so my point is that a community should have... Now, if the Duck Pond Association decided that we are going to, you know, distribute a lot of Prabhupada's books, that would be a spiritual project for the community. So my question is, what is the spiritual project, what is the preaching project of a community as a community? It's a community project where all the people in the community get together. Obviously, you know, it's the old, you know, formulas that only a certain percentage of people really do a lot of the work and other people just assist in lesser ways. But still, as a community, what is the community preaching project? It seems to me that in a preaching movement, in a Sankirtan movement, that's an extremely valid question to say, what is the Sankirtan project in a community which claims to be part of a Sankirtan movement?
And then there's the question, what can we, each one of us, as individuals, do to help accomplish that?
I would say, first of all, there has to be a certain awareness. I don't think the action can precede the awareness.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there's a stage in which people, first of all, have to wake up in any community. I mean, in Lhasa or anywhere else, and just sort of wake up and realize what's going on and where are we and what is this? So I think the first stage is awareness. To understand and not to take for granted, as we often do, that because we're devotees and not non-devotees, therefore, if you get enough of us in the same place, it's a spiritual community. Which I don't think is true. It's just not true, and yet we tend to think that way. Yeah, Radhika, I think, was waiting to ask a question.
I totally agree with what you're saying. One thing I was thinking about yesterday when you were talking about what is our preaching project here in Lhasa.
Yeah.
And that's something that I think about. But one obstacle I personally see, you know, there's four different elements that Satchinanda Maharaj talks about as far as going forward in spiritual life, which I believe are part of the elements of the spiritual community. community means to come together with a common goal. It is a spiritual community. It's one where our common goal is to revive our true spiritual consciousness and to help others do that. Isn't it?
Yes.
So, in thinking about Alachua, I think that there's maybe unawareness, there's some lethargy as obstacles. But personally, from what I've seen, is that there are also obstacles that are not being addressed in the sense of economical, social, maybe even physical, some health issues, these elements that are needed to go forward. You even talk about that, having the basic foundation down. There are still divorces.
I would reverse the sequence. And I would say that, as Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita, it's the higher taste. It's the higher taste which inspires us to do all the right things. In other words, I think there's a direct connection between a community, let's say, whether or not you really care about your neighbors in terms of their physical, emotional, financial needs, and whether you care about spreading the Sankirtan movement. And I think devotees who are truly committed to spreading Krishna consciousness would do so not out of a sort of an immature fanaticism, but out of a genuine, mature, adult compassion. And if you're compassionate in that way, how could you not care about people's other needs?
So that's what I'm saying, that perhaps if there was more taking care of the devotees, specifically to me, then that could help with the picture.
Although I think that if people started to get a higher taste and recognize what Prabhupada's real mission is, it would lead to more humanitarian attitudes.
So then God's hand in hand, yes?
However, the higher taste comes from the Sankirtan movement. And we can see many communities, like, let's say, historically Christian communities, where they very much emphasize humanitarian activity and never really came to the spiritual platform. So does humanitarian work among religious people bring them automatically to the spiritual platform? No, it doesn't. In fact, because without the higher taste of preaching, people go deeper and deeper into the bodily concept of life, and the humanitarian work becomes the religion.
So you're saying start with a spiritual project and simultaneously take care of the needs of the devotees, and it goes hand in hand.
It's a historical dialectic, you know, thesis, antithesis, synthesis. The thesis was extreme self-denial, like never mind your bodily needs, your emotional needs, never mind your family, never mind anything, go out and sell books. Mm-hmm. So that was one extreme.
Yeah.
And then it obviously led to its equal and opposite extreme, which is, never mind the preaching, get your family together, get yourself together. You know, I already killed myself in my youth out there, and so now I have to worry about me and my family, blah, blah, blah. And so you go to the other extreme, and you're equally unbalanced. So the synthesis is, we take the best of both, and you move forward. The best of both, so what we need is a movement which is mature about human needs, at the same time is mobilized and enthusiastic about saving the world. And to think that these two are somehow contradictory or they can't coexist, I think, is to be basically stupid. And yet there was kind of a mood. I mean, it's almost like in the early days of the movement, caring for your basic health or your family was kind of Maya. And now there's some people, some devotees for whom taking the Sankirtan movement seriously is almost shows that you're an irresponsible human being. And so we have to move forward. And the higher taste, Lord Chaitanya said the higher taste is Sankirtan. I know myself in my own humble way, because Krishna has been very kind to me and given me some facility in my own personal life, which actually doesn't come from donations from disciples. I mean, Krishna gives me the opportunity to help many people. And I feel grateful for that. Krishna's given me the opportunity to help many, many devotees in different ways and around the world. And I take great pleasure in that. And so for me, it's all the same thing. It's like, that's why I'm preaching. That's why I'm writing books. That's why I try to do what I can within my means to help devotees in need. It's all the same thing.
Talk about
books. Yes, it's finished. So I think that we have to get that higher taste back. I mean, it's a Sankirtan movement. It's a Sankirtan movement. That's the higher taste. That's what Lord Chaitanya said. And so...
A weekly Sankirtan is considered a spiritual activity?
Can you speak on the mic?
Just what everybody else can hear.
Is a weekly sankirtan party considered a spiritual activity?
Of course it is. Worshiping the deity is a spiritual activity. Sankirtan is a spiritual activity.
From a spiritual community.
However, if I basically have a material life and occasionally I perform a spiritual activity, that's great, that's wonderful, but that's what it is. It's like when we go out in Sankirtan and sell a book to someone, that's a person who basically has a material life, but buying the book is a spiritual activity. When you sell a book to someone, they're engaged as much as you are in a spiritual activity. When we go on Harinam, the person listening is engaged in a spiritual activity as much as the person chanting. But when the kirtan's over, everybody, the chanter and the listener, goes back to their material life.
Not necessarily.
Not necessarily, but in many cases. And so what I'm saying is, that a spiritual life or a spiritual community, now it doesn't, to be a spiritual community, it doesn't require that everyone be an advanced devotee. But if the community had a spiritual goal, a mission, a preaching mission, and everyone cooperated, because nowadays, without a spiritual mission for the community, I would say most of the devotees, say in Alachua, are sincere. I think most of them are sincere. I think most of them have their heart in the right place. And they're actually very, where are the opportunities? Like, what do you do? Does every individual have to invent their own little Sankirtan movement? And another point is that in order to have a powerful Sankirtan movement, you have to have strong leadership. It doesn't have to come from a banana republic dictator. It doesn't have to. It doesn't mean tyranny necessarily. You could have a democratically based strong leadership.
Do I hear a volunteering?
What?
Huh?
No, you don't. Actually, I'm volunteering my good advice. As they say, it's a tough job, but someone has to delegate it. So. No, but the point is that if you, it's like, let's say after 9/11, to use just like a cliche example, when there's really an emergency, if something happens, or let's say if there's a flood somewhere, suddenly everyone gets mobilized, and people come in, and someone takes charge, whether it's some, you know, person from some government organ or whatever, okay, you do this, you do that, you take this, and suddenly a much higher level of coordination and discipline kicks in. Why? Because it's really serious. It's important. When people understand there's really an important job to get done, this really matters, like bad things are going to happen if we don't do this, suddenly people get organized, they get disciplined, there's authority, there's power, and things start to move. So if a community has sort of like allergic to strong leadership, even if the strong leadership is elected by them, in other words, I think what it is, it's like a type of phantom limb. You know, it's like someone, God forbid, has a limb amputated, but they still feel it. It's like someone loses a leg, but the leg still itches and hurts, even though there's no leg there. And so I think some people are like suffering from phantom temple presidents and phantom phantom leaders, in the sense that strong leadership means someone comes in and starts to dictate to you how to live your life. That's not what we're talking about. If you take, let's say, a dynamic church or a synagogue or something like that, they have an organization where everything's voluntary. People have their own lives, their families, their houses, cars, and pinball machines, and they come together into a certain organization. And within that organization, which is only one aspect of their life, there's leadership and there's authority. And some people give orders and some people follow them. And it doesn't mean for anyone that someone's taking over your life. It just means that within that context, like when you go to a university and you enroll in the university, you have to follow certain rules. It doesn't mean you become enslaved. It means within that specific context, for that particular purpose, you have to follow the rules. So in the same way, in order to have a Sankirtan community, you have to have a situation where people are willing to get involved. And within the context of a particular committee or organization or project, they follow rules, they have a leader, there's obedience, there's discipline in the ranks, and the community, as a community, gets something done. As a community. Something in the field of Bhagavad Vidhi. Not simply in the field of deity worship, which we all love and we all need. All of us need to see the deity. However, if all the organization and all the discipline is on the Pancharatric side, and you got this train running like this, you know, on one track, it's where's the other track? Where's the discipline? Where's the authority? Where's the volunteering? Where's the fundraising to save the world?
Acharya Dev, you're very merciful.
I am.
You are. And because you've been here in this area of the world, maybe Krishna's talking through you and trying to inspire you to take on this leadership.
Oh, oh my goodness.
Who else will have the spiritual strength to take on so many
transcendental brain to be such a thing? Because it takes a transcendental brain to be such a thing. As you said, a leader has to, you know, the people have to know that they're not going to take over my life, and the leader also has to accept that I will not be taking over these people's lives.
Oh, absolutely. Oh my God, I wouldn't take your life if you gave it to me. Because, I mean, I burned out decades ago on taking over other people's lives. But you're right, yes.
Some people
agree to that. Want someone to take over their lives.
They don't have to understand. This is not what's happening. We're working on this.
You want a microphone? Why don't you?
Microphone.
Come on.
Come on.
Hey, now come on.
She has to come here.
Well, I'm gonna come here.
People's choice.
I was thinking back when you were saying about the leader will not be taking over the people's lives, but just leading them in the mission. So the people also have to understand and accept that, and not want the leader to take over their lives. And become responsible in the mission, and you know, their lives are, you know, part of the mission, but they have to understand how to balance that themselves. That's why it requires, like, when we're talking about leadership, it requires someone who will understand that and really be submissive to the mission himself.
Somebody has to do it.
Don't go away.
Hi, Krishna. Thank you so much for talking about the subject. Actually, whenever I would visit Alachua in the past, people would always ask, oh, so you're moving here? And I would always say, no, I'm not moving to Alachua. And it was like the last place I ever wanted to move. And it wasn't because there's anything wrong with the community, but just because of this one point, that I felt like I wanted to be part of the front lines. I wanted to be out there doing some preaching, and I felt that if I moved to this community that I would be, you know, retired, that I would be taking care of my family and not really participating. But since I have moved here, and I see that that's not really the case, but the front lines are, they appear different, and, you know, not necessarily out distributing books, but, you know, behind the scenes sort of thing, but you said yourself that it starts with awareness, and who better to raise this kind of awareness than your divine being?
Thank you for volunteering.
Please, give me till my food. Well, I mean, if you consider how many devotees there are here, if devotees, I mean, not right here, but when you have such a large community, if everyone could agree on a project and really be enthusiastic about it, and imagine for the children, because I think one of the most important things in raising children is to give them a higher taste, because it's that, I know there's some parents here who engage their children in different types of preaching activities, theater, different things, and I mean, the children actually have a higher taste. They actually have a taste of spreading, and that's the higher taste that attaches the children when they grow up to Prabhupada's movement. That is the higher taste. And so the idea that we can't preach because we have to focus on our children seems to me is really a materialistic philosophy. Because one of the main, obviously you have to feed your children, love your children, take care of them, and all that. But one of the most important things to give your children is a higher taste. Because that's what's going to save them from materialism. And materialism leads to even all kinds of, you know, medical, psychological problems and disasters. People that get involved in materialistic life, you know, can get involved in substance abuse, can become suicidal, enter into really bad marriages, can just get into all kinds of weird, bizarre, unhealthy situations. And what we really need is that higher taste, which protects us, which keeps us in touch with Krishna, and keeps us under Krishna's protection. So it's a type of vanity also in false ego. We have to remember that it's really Krishna who is the only protector. I mean, of course, we do our duty. Anyone that's under our care, we have to do everything humanly possible to take care of them. But at the same time, ultimately, it's only Krishna that can protect our children. And the way we keep our children connected to Krishna is to give them a higher taste. And then higher taste comes... I mean, if children don't learn unselfishness, they'll become selfish. If children don't learn to serve and to help others, and if they don't learn the higher taste of just trying to save the world, how will they avoid a selfish life and all the pain and misery that comes from selfishness? Because actually, Krishna says in the Gita that suffering comes from selfishness, from material passion. And if our children are selfish, all of our affection and all of our money won't save them from suffering. Some of the most miserable young people in the world are the children of rich people.
But I think all over the movement, like I said, there's so many sincere devotees
yes.
here and everywhere. We all want good leadership. It's not, nobody's raising a flag. We don't want good leadership.
Con todo respeto. There are communities, I mean, yeah, I would say, just to be very honest, in 3 months, I would say, to be honest, that, yeah, there are definitely some people who are somewhat allergic to strong leadership. And there are definitely communities that are, I know one community, which is thousands of miles away from here, where, I mean, I visited there several years ago, I can't remember, 7 years ago, all merging now. But I visited there, and they were, and it's like, it was a really bad experience for me, which was a very good experience, because it's, you know, think of Krishna. But a lot of people in that community went out of their way to let me know how little they thought of me, which I thought was great hospitality. And I've been to places, I mean, I remember that I felt like, my God, my Aunt Esther used to be nicer than this when I visited her. So, anyway, so they just went out of their way publicly to let me know that I was nothing. You know, just continue the story. So then what happened, and they were very proud of the fact they didn't want any leaders. They were very proud of it. They were boasting about it, how they didn't want any leaders. And what happened is then that... several people in the community, you know, nature abhors a vacuum, then, quote-unquote, took shelter of a Gaudiya Math, what I call the Gaudiya Vikings. There's a particular group. And then it was a real problem. It was a real problem for the community, and they were really shocked. It was a real wake-up call. And then it changed their mentality. They began to appreciate the value of faithful, real spiritual leadership, and the community got much better. But yeah, actually I can say honestly, based on my personal experience and based on things I've heard from reliable, intelligent people, that yes, there are communities where, if not the average devotees, but definitely there is a current of resistance. There's definitely a resistance to strong leadership, even if that leadership is elected by them.
And how would you rate a lot from 1 to 10 in this sense? How would you rate Alatra
like
from 1 to 10? In this sense, 10 being the best and 1 being the worst.
It's like 60. It's just a number. How would I rate Alashua? I would be diplomatic and not rate it. Because for one thing, I haven't spent that much time there lately, in the last couple of years, and so I really don't know.
But in general, now you gave one example, but I think that's, I think it's an exception. In general, the devotees are...
I can say one thing. That, I mean, and I say this, I really pray to Krishna, not saying this with anything like bitterness or anything like that, or anger. But my personal experience was that that after being here for 2.5 months, I was invited to give a lecture in the temple in Alachua. After 2.5 months here. Now, the people who are in charge of organizing the classes and everything, I mean, I think they're actually nice devotees. I know they're nice devotees. They're not envious. They're good people. But to say that, I mean, we've announced programs and have like 3 or 4 people come. So I know for a fact that something is a little slightly out of focus. Because I know myself, I mean, I personally get invitations from all around the world. I have to like fight off all these invitations. And after two and a half months, I was invited to give a lecture in the temple at the last minute before a major festival. So, again, I mean, I really pray to Krishna that I'm not saying this with anything like anger or... But actually, I mean, it's obviously, it's not what you call a healthy spiritual atmosphere. So we don't want to be in denial. It's interesting because I think we went through so many years in the early days of the movement, fighting off attacks by demons and deprogrammers and also sane people that thought we were out of control. But anyway, we went through so much of that we sort of developed this mentality, which is common in unhealthy corporations, where, you know, it's criticizing ourselves is a sign of disloyalty. I think those who actually love ISKCON, those who actually are dedicating their lives to ISKCON, and will always dedicate their lives to ISKCON, one of their duties, especially at a certain stage in your life, is to offer reasonable, well-intentioned criticism.
You know, a guru has the right to criticize. That's, but no one else.
Really?
Yeah.
Are you being facetious?
Not even if you're very intelligent, like, you know, but if you're not a guru.
But, you know, which level of devotee should the criticism go to? To this rank or to the management?
I would say that, and then you can speak after that. I would say that depending on your rank, that may determine the etiquette which should with which you make the criticism. I mean, I have one disciple who's Ali Krishna, who did a lot of the work. She's a wonderful young devotee. And she told me one time that she had made some criticism of some devotees, and she felt it really was hurting her spiritual life. And yet she's an intelligent person. And so I think that the truth can be spoken. After all, it's the last leg of Dharma in this age. But depending on my position within the society, that should determine the type of etiquette with which I make a criticism. I know, like, if a disciple of mine comes into me and says, dude, you know, you really, or whatever, I don't know. So, I think we have to separate the, it's like my mother used to tell me, it's not what you say, it's how you say it. So I think the truth is spoken appropriately, then it can and should be spoken. But yeah, I mean, and the truth can come from anyone. What's that? Speaking truth to power. Isn't that one of those old sayings? Having the courage to speak truth to power. Like in the old biblical prophetic tradition, speaking truth to power. Well, I think that the truth has its own shakti. It's like, may the force be with you. And so if something is true and we speak it with good intention, without envy, without pride, and we speak the truth to those who will listen to us, then I think, you know, the truth may catch on.
Yes, right time, place, circumstance.
Manner.
Listeners.
Yeah. Back there, where's that? Yeah, you wanted to...
Following Lilananda Puri's point, and I feel like there's a lot of people in the community, at least right now, that ever in the past, I would say, 8 months to a year, have tried, have seen the problem. I want to call it a problem, but issues in the community of past believers, where basically we want to feel challenges, where we want to feel inspired with each other's association, and we're living in the biggest devoted community in North America, and really take advantage of that. And there's a few people that, a few shining members in the community that are really doing a lot, but I don't know if, my question is, do you feel that problem, like, for example, having been here for 2.5 months and only been asked to speak after that much time, do you feel that that's a reflection of the community or as a reflection of the management?
They say in Brazil that todo povo tem o governo que merece. That every society has a government it deserves. And, I mean, first of all, it doesn't make me think really badly of anyone. Because I think the devotees in general, Atra, are very good, sincere devotees. I think rather the situation is problematic. And so, if I can be a little specific, actually, the risk of perhaps, well, losing a few votes. And that is, to me, it's a no-brainer as far as what Alachua should be doing. As follows. First of all, is the mission of, you know, 1,000 devotees or 800 devotees or 6, whatever it is their mission to sort of swarm all over the town of Alachua converting people? I think that you know, everyone's spirit, I think Alachua is a severely limited field. You know, we can certainly make devotees there, but it's Alachua. As far as Gainesville, we are blessed with a very good preaching program in Gainesville, and I think to some extent, I mean, well, we know a lot of good work, more could be done in Gainesville, but I still don't think that we could necessarily engage hundreds of devotees swarming over even the city of Gainesville. To me, the real point is that Florida is one of the main tourist destinations in the world. Our farm is just a few miles away from one of the main highways by which people come to Florida. Millions and probably tens of millions of people come down Highway 75. And so to me, it's like a no-brainer that somehow or other that land we have, rather than just, moderate my speech here. I had the experience of taking a certain piece of that land back in the, you know, good old days, and we developed it so beautifully. Tidix, you remember that? The gardens were so beautiful, everything was so well kept, but I remember that literally, we had people like philosophy professors, bank presidents, all kinds of respectable people come there, and it literally took their breath away. I remember one lady who was a philosophy professor came out there, and she just sat on the patio, just sighing. She just couldn't speak for minutes. She was just, it just literally took her breath away. And I remember another professor who was the chairman of the religion department at UF coming there, and we were walking around the pond, which used to be kept up, and he said, I remember him saying to me, I know we're not supposed to be attached, but this is... he tried to think of somebody, he said, well, this is so conducive. And then I had the pleasure of going, hey, Haribo! I had the pleasure of going back and seeing there to become literally a slum. It's what I call VG, Vedic Ghetto. And in good faith, I gave that, you know, we spent a lot of money, Brahma Tirtha spent money, I spent money, and we developed that to become just an exquisite preaching area, and it literally turned into a slum. So, it seems to me that what could be done is to make New Raman Reddy a major tourist attraction in Florida, not by, you know, some cockeyed idea or spend tens of millions of dollars, but simply by developing perhaps what you call a Vedic village, you know, simple living. I mean, after all, when I was a kid, I went to Disneyland, and there was Frontierland, and there was, you know, one of the lands was just simple living. People loved that stuff. In an age when the focus of intellectual activism in the modern world is the environment. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, sustainable living. That is the last sort of stronghold of anything like intelligent activism in the world. Like, I wouldn't consider jihad to be intelligent activism. So, here we have a piece of land in Florida, right off one of the main tourist routes, and it's not rocket science to figure out what we should be doing. And you have hundreds and hundreds of people who are basically concerned with their own lives. So, it seems to me, and their lives may involve preaching in their own way. Their lives may involve worshiping Krishna. I'm not saying their own lives are all bad or material. But in terms of the community, having a community project where you could actually say, New Raman Reddy is a preaching project. New Raman Reddy is a vital part of Lord Chaitanya's Sankirtan movement.
You know, this is such a good idea, because that's something, it's something that the devotees that live around there can actually do. You know, the families, the second generation, there's so much manpower that can be used for this kind of project, to make it beautiful, to have a nice atmosphere that people will come and kind of walk leisurely.
You could get millions of people coming to New Raman Reddy. You get millions of people, and then if you have devotee restaurants and gift shops, you generate millions of dollars. You could actually generate your own economy and employ devotees. People don't have to drive to Orlando to sell, I don't know,
hats.
or something else, or, you know, screwdrivers shaped like pretzels or something that you can eat. But the point is, you could actually generate a very large economy here. You could generate an economy so that people, fathers, could actually stay with their children. Fathers could be home for their children. Mothers could be with their kids. You could keep families together. And, you know, you could generate a very powerful economy. The tourist industry in Florida is a multi-billion dollar industry, and we're right off one of the main routes, and we have land, and we have something exotic. If we're anything, we're exotic. Mm-hmm. And it just so happens that, you know, environmentalism is one of the main points of convergence between the modern world and Prabhupada's preaching. It's one of the most powerful points of convergence. And you can get millions of people coming there, generate a very powerful economy, employ people, save families because parents could stay with their children and work, you know, very close to their home. It would solve everything. And that's a way, that's a sense in which the Sankirtan movement will solve our material problems. After all, isn't it Prabhupada that always taught us that if you just water the root, everything will be done? That if you solve your relationship with Krishna, it will solve all problems? So we're the last people in the world that should start preaching at first, do everything material, and do the Krishna thing later. I mean, if we start saying that, then the whole world's gone nuts.
Even Kanapa High Garden.
Microphone for the lady, please. Yes.
There's Kanapa High Gardens, not far from us, in High Springs, and they have the tourist attraction. They have beautiful gardens there. People go to see that. They sell things, and they have a nice little... It's a smaller kind of attraction. And then there's a larger one the Christians have off of Kissimmee. And then, they have, it's like a... With that, the Holy Land experience, yes, thank you. They have like from the Bible times, they have everything set up and facades of like temples and whatever, and they have people acting in certain ways from the Bible times, and it's a big attraction. It's kind of a but yet it's not as expensive as Disney World. I mean, to make it, it's not like that.
And we have the first shot at most Americans coming down because they come down 75 before they ever get down to. We could have an interactive museum. So that not only our temples are interactive museums, but... Mm-hmm. Yes, go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so excited to hear you say this. Radhika and I were giving each other looks. For the last month, we've been talking exactly about this subject matter, just exactly what you've been talking about, almost the whole thing, almost not exactly verbatim because you're more eloquent, but we've been talking about this, and we were so excited, and we were thinking, well, maybe this is why, you know,
our
generation, you know, we're somehow or other not able to get things together materially that well, because we're supposed to do, you know, this is what I consider Varnashram, which is simple living, high thinking, like with the seminar business, people coming, attractions, you know, like this whole thing in Alaska. I thought, oh, wow, maybe I could actually do preaching here and you know, do a community like that. But then every time I bring this out, people go, but the permits, you know, and then as if that's like the end all and be all of the whole idea. And I don't think
that's the permits.
I don't think that if this is Krishna's plan for our society here in Florida, you know, which I just recently joined and probably shouldn't say too much about, but it seems like that shouldn't really be that huge of an obstacle, but everybody seems to think that it's just not possible.
Yeah. Well, I mean, can you imagine that? That's like a movie. It's like a comedy. Like, here you have a chance to save the world, create this fantastic spiritual community, but the permits, you know, it's like a comedy.
I would like to take a different look on this, Penny. Now, in this one, we had many propositions, many great ideas that never materialized. And at least in this community, they have done something that has attracted many souls that perhaps would not be attracted to go to any other community. So this must be their credit.
I think, yeah, we should be kind.
At least they have something to show.
I think that my experience is that some of the larger communities, like, frankly, New Dwarka, like Alachua, they tend to be incredibly self-absorbed and almost deluded about the rest of the world, what's going on. And, you know, they have these maps, the world is seen by New Yorkers. And it's like the five boroughs are basically seven-eighths of the earth. And then there's like little footnotes, like the rest of North and South America, Europe, Asia, and so on. And, yeah, I mean, the devotees here are good devotees. They've done something nice. We should certainly be generous. But at the same time, if we become allergic to any, you know, real, even constructive criticism, if our response to every new idea is to praise ourselves, then, you know, it's like a textbook case of the sick corporation, which you know very well because you know about corporations. Of course it's a nice community in many ways. Of course there are good people. Of course something good has been done. But the point is, we have to move on.
Highest tree. You're going to lead us to this new
swing from the highest tree.
There has been more talk lately just about what you're saying, so to feed your fire. There's definitely more interest coming, and a lot from the second generation. We've got a really good group of young people in Alachua who really work well together, so I think there has to be some cooperation with management, but I think we can start with the enthusiasm that we have where it is, because there are pockets of enthusiasm. And, as you know, we have so many amazing presenters who put on performances that we just needed this three modes play over the Love Thy Neighbor weekend, and it was, it's on YouTube. It was such good preaching. My only regret was that there were not more non-devotees there to see it, because it was so clear, straight from the Bhagavad Gita, the three modes of material nature.
What we should do is we should spread the link.
I saw it on the San Diego.
But I mean, all over, straight out.
And a lot of people obviously move here because of the families and because of the children.
Imagine if there was a devotee economy.
Right. So my question, I have one question for you.
Yeah.
Well, Mukhya also is working on rezoning at the temple.
Uh-huh.
And there is some plans of doing restaurants, moving Krishna.com to the front to have a storefront. There's also a devotee who lives right next door that has 20 acres of land that we could talk to. So my question is, when do we get started? Seriously. I'm serious.
Yeah, I think we should talk. Because I think, you know,
can we set up a meeting like this?
Yeah, yeah, sure. I think what you could do is you could invite all the interested people and we'll meet.
Okay. Mother Kuti is coming to our house 1 week from now. She's going to talk about Varnashram. She's also very inspired this way. And we have a younger Dogon Gurukulis who meet every 2 weeks. And they're inviting, we invite devotees to come, advanced devotees to come and talk. So if you want to come during that time, there'll already be a group of devotees there. If you have
Yeah, we should just gather the people who are relevant to the project and I'll do my part.
This is perfect timing.
Campaign manager. All right. My handler, make sure I don't say the wrong thing.
Thank you.
Yeah, of course. So what time is it now?
2:30.
So then we'll wrap it up. Mm-hmm. Anyway, you've all been great contestants.